Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. He was the first American master of horror, detective fiction, mystery. Edgar Allan Poe turns 200 this week. You read him in high school, no doubt, but his eerie, ghoulish, haunted spirit keeps on speaking. Here's actor Vincent Price with one of Poe's most popular poems, The Raven, Once Upon a Midnight Dreary.
While I nodded, nearly napping, suddenly there came a tapping, as of someone gently rapping, rapping at my chamber door.
And pretty soon it's never more. Edgar Allan Poe was a tortured soul, his death a bizarre mystery. His work still echoes like the telltale heart in our culture today. This hour On Point, master of the macabre, Edgar Allan Poe at 200. You can join the conversation. Did you, do you love Poe? All that gothic romance, murder, horror. What was he tapped into? And do you see it all around us in our popular culture today? Joining me now from Baton Rouge in Louisiana is J. Gerald Kennedy. He's a professor of English at Louisiana State University and has been thinking and writing about Poe for 35 years. He's author of many books on Poe, the most recent, The Portable, Edgar Allan Poe. Jerry Kennedy, welcome. Wonderful to have you with us.
Thank you, Tom. It's good to be with you.
With us from Nice in France, lucky man, is Stephen Rackman, professor of English at Michigan State University, president of the Poe Studies Association. He's co-editor of The American Face of Edgar Allan Poe in France right now for an international Edgar Allan Poe convention. Stephen Rackman, welcome to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom. It's good to be here.
So they've heard of Poe over there in France?
Yes, they have. Heard of Poe for almost as long as we have, in a certain way, since 1846, when he was first translated into French and became something of a sensation. And they're still deeply interested in Poe.
Translated by Baudelaire, no less. Jerry Kennedy, rereading about Edgar Allan Poe, was struck by so many things, by not least by how he was kind of the impoverished blogger of his day, one of the first Americans to try to make a living at writing, and it wasn't easy. The Raven made him a superstar, and he made $9 from it.
Yes, he had a very difficult life. He broke into the magazine trade in 1832 with a tale called Metzengerstein, and he, in the course of his career, held four editorial positions, one at the Southern Literary Messenger, one at Burton's Gentleman's Magazine, another at Graham's Magazine, and finally the Broadway Journal. But all during that time, Poe struggled. He was booted out of the first three jobs, in effect. And his life really was an ongoing effort to keep body and soul together in a very literal sense.
Joined the military early on, was posted for $5 a month in the military to Boston Harbor, had a brief stint at West Point, was at the University of Virginia, got kicked out, gambling debts, lost women in his life, first his mother, very young, and then the woman who never adopted him, but from the family, the Allen family, that gave him his middle name, and finally Stephen Rackman, the cousin who he married when she was just 13, and he was maybe twice that. When did Poe begin to turn to the kind of poetry and short stories that we know him so well for today? His editing is sort of lost in the mist of time, but his work certainly isn't.
Well, that's certainly true. His editing was the thing he was first known for, though there's evidence in his biography that he had ambitions as a poet first, and of course the first things that he published were collections of poems. His work Tamerlane, which was published in Boston, is still recognized as the rarest and perhaps most valuable work of 19th century American literature.
50 copies only in that printing, as I recall.
Yeah, there used to be stories that you could go to old barns in Vermont somewhere and try and find someone who didn't know what they had and dig up this treasure, but I haven't heard of any since for quite a while. And so he did begin with poetry, and then as he broke through with several stories and then becoming an editor, he was known as an aggressive critic The Tomahawk Man was his nickname. And he made a reputation for creating little controversies, being aggressive. He knew that that sold, and he was always trying to convince his editors that creating controversies was a good way in that time to sell magazines. And he would sort of work through those. And then in the context of that, he produced the stories and poems that we know him for.
You describe him as a kind of rock star of that period, early 19th century America, and rock star in the sense of somebody who was brilliant but troubled, and people knew it. What is this, kind of Alice Cooper of his time, Stephen?
I don't know if I would call him Alice Cooper. Wouldn't be the rock. What rock star would Poe be? Yeah, with the eyes, I guess. He didn't need the makeup under the eyes right. to be Alice Cooper. Yeah, he was a kind of a troubled figure. People, he had literary enemies, and he had friends. People knew of some difficulties with drinking. We can talk about that. That's always a controversial subject. But so he sort of cast a figure as someone who was a little bit dangerous. And he was poor. When Dickens came to visit him in 1842 on his American tour, he'd recognized him as a literary figure of some eminence and intelligence, and he was shocked at his threadbare clothing. There's a story of him walking in the woods near Fordham and splitting his pants, trying to show off athletically. He often prided himself on his athletic prowess, and he rips his pants And there's this kind of concern in the house that they're going to have to sew up these pants because he doesn't have other pairs. It's that level of poverty that we're talking about. And so, he sort of cast this kind of figure as a gentleman on one hand, and then as a man who's Byronically dangerous to know.
Jerry Kennedy, within that poverty, he laid down markers in a number of genres that still mark, in some way, their beginning point. When people talk about horror, when they talk about detective stories and mystery as we know them today, the line appears to go straight back to Poe.
That's absolutely true. Poe was constantly pushing the envelope, trying to sort of work on the threshold of what he could get away with. As Steve mentioned, he really relished the notion of stirring up controversy, and he was always trying to write works that were just on the edge of what could be acceptable or palatable to a public. He got chewed out for one of his early stories, Berenice, because it was so miserably grotesque and ended with a kind of bad dental fantasy. He certainly did pioneer genres like science fiction. He wrote an early piece about a balloon flight to the moon. It was a hoaxical tale, but there were elements in it that were very compelling and interesting to think about. Later on, he produced another balloon hoax about a balloon flight across the Atlantic Ocean. And, of course, his novel, Arthur Gordon Pym, is about a fantastic voyage that finally takes his protagonist to the South Pole and into the South Pole, if we're to sort of follow the imaginative thread that he lays down for us. And, of course, he was also the inventor of the detective story, the famous Dupin stories that appeared in the early 1840s, really created the model. And still today, there is an International Edgar Award for mystery writers that reflects the enduring presence of Poe in that genre.
Go back to the murders in the Rue Morgue, and you'll know all about that. The Pit and the Pendulum for Horror, The Telltale Heart, and you can hear Stephen King beating in there, The Black Cat, The Fall of the House of Usher, and even in the poems. Stephen Reckman, what was it about Poe that pushed him to the fantastical and the morbid, even the grotesque, the very anatomically grotesque? Is this just where he found sales, or was it in his psyche?
Well, in some ways, Tom, I think that's the unanswerable question, in the sense that these nightmares seem to be in us, in human beings in general. And Poe was He was attuned, though, to science, to the ideas that were circulating in his own day about inventions, the hoaxes that Jerry mentioned. There were other hoaxes that he wrote, Facts in the Case of M. Valdemar, Monsieur Valdemar, which is another hoax about mesmerism, where, you know, mesmerism is what we'd call hypnotism today.
Mm-hmm.
This, at the time, seemed to give people access to that same dark world that you were thinking of. Only he thought of it as the line between life and death. And it has someone in the story actually saying, I say to you that I am dead. An impossible statement, of course. But people were curious. They thought it was a factual account. There are records of people discussing the adventures of narrative of Arthur Gordon Pym as a factual account. And so, as you know well today, the pseudo-documentary or the pseudo-memoir is a staple of our society. It seems that people want to blur the line between fact and fiction. And so in Poe's deepest horrors, there's always an element of the matter of fact, of the scientific, of the quotidian, the everyday. And I think that that tension in modern life between the world and the modern world is something that he found a way to articulate in the modern short story, which he also... I hear music coming on.
father of that as well. Hold it there, yeah, in France, if you would, Stephen Rackman. Yeah. Jerry Kennedy there as well. We're talking about Edgar Allan Poe, master of the macabre. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Edgar Allan Poe, master of the macabre at 200, born in January 1809, this week in that year. Gerald Kennedy, Jerry Kennedy, joins us from Baton Rouge. He's professor of English at Louisiana State and has been thinking and writing about Edgar Allan Poe for a very long time, knows him inside and out. So does Stephen Rackman, joining us today from Nice in France. Out of Michigan State, he's at a big convention on Poe in France this week. Let's listen to a little more of Vincent Price. Here he is playing the madman in Edgar Allan Poe's 1843 story, The Telltale Heart. Story follows a narrator who insists that he's not insane after murdering an old man. Here from the opening of the story, Vincent Price, as the madman, explains why he had to kill the old man.
I think it was his eye. Yes, it was this. One of his eyes resembled that of a vulture, a pale blue eye with a film over it. Whenever it fell upon me, my blood ran cold. And so by degrees, very gradually, I made up my mind to take the life of the old man and thus to rid myself of the eye forever. Now, this is the point. You fancy me mad. Madmen know nothing, but you should have seen me. You should have seen how wisely I proceeded, with what caution, with what foresight. I was never kinder to the old man than during the whole week before I killed him.
Yeah, nobody had more fun than Vincent Price with Edgar Allan Poe and that old heart beating beneath the floor. Let's get a call from Berlin in Germany. Terrence, thanks for calling. You're on the air, Terrence.
Hi, Tom. Hello, gentlemen.
Hello.
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 Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Terrific. Hey, fantastic show. I'm really happy that you're focusing on Poe at his 200th birthday. I'm actually in Berlin at the moment doing a master's program in American Studies, and I'm currently taking a seminar on Edgar Allan Poe. And for me, it's a total reintroduction. Of course, as an American, I grew up with his work. But one of the things I find so fascinating about all of his stories, be it science fiction, detective, poetry, whatnot, is Poe seemed to display an absolute understanding of human psychology on multiple levels. And I think that's why his work resonates to this day. You just played that Vincent Price clip from The Telltale Heart.
Mm-hmm.
If you have internet access, I would recommend for your listeners that you play the James Mason version from the Columbia Pictures 1953 production, which back then actually had been rated X.
wow.
But I'm personally in love with the Mason, with the James Mason. production.
That's great. Terrence, you know your stuff, right back to the 1953 version, but your point on human psychology is maybe the beating heart of the matter here. Jerry Kennedy, you talk about Poe's foresight, almost presaging a whole nother century, being ahead of his 19th century in his sense of violence, his perception of this sort of madness and spiritual doubt and terror even that would come more along in the 20th century, Jerry.
Yeah, that's right, Tom. In the Oxford Historical Guide to Poe, I tried to lay out some of the reasons why it is that Poe seems again and again to be so utterly contemporary. He anticipated, as you mentioned in the lead-in to the program, sensation, violence, madness, alienation, and the spiritual doubt. And all of those traits, all of those phenomena became so pervasive in the 20th century and have followed us into the 21st. One of the most perceptive comments on Poe was made by Sarah Helen Whitman, to whom he was very briefly engaged in 1848. She commented in a book that she wrote after Poe's death that the faithlessness of the age culminated in Poe. He was the first to gaze into this abyss of disbelief. And I think there is a profound insight there, but I would also balance that by saying that there was also in Poe a kind of agonizing desire for faith, a yearning to articulate a notion of God. And of course, we see that abundantly in Eureka, one of his last works. But the quality in Poe that I find personally most compelling and contemporary right now, and I didn't think to slip this into that introduction I was writing 9 years ago, is terror. Poe anticipates the age of terrorism. And I would say that if readers want to go to works that give us an analysis of terrorism, go to The Pit and the Pendulum, go to Hop Frog. These are stories that I think brilliantly explore the relationship between the victim and the tormentor.
Stephen Rackman, he was ahead of his time in this. He was writing in an age when transcendentalism and much that was bright and holy was big. He became alienated from a lot of Bostonians as a result. He got much less than rave critical reviews from the literary set of his time. But what do you think had him looking into the abyss of disbelief so early?
Well, I think that's quite true that he was certainly the transcendentalists. They had no love for each other. Emerson famously called him the Jingle Man. But a quote that I like better from a Bostonian who did admire Poe and was the editor of the Atlantic Monthly, James Russell Lowell, says, "Here comes Poe and his raven like Barnaby Rudge," alluding to Dickens' novel where the raven probably comes from. "Three-fifths pure genius and two-fifths fudge."
And by fudge, he meant what? Popular, playing to the crowd?
Yeah, he meant BS. he meant a sort of sense of what Poe said about detective fiction. There's more air of method than method about it. That is, it looks like it's science, but it's actually more rigged in a certain way. And there's a mixture of faith and skepticism that Jerry was alluding to that oscillates in Poe's writing. And I think that, you know, if you think about The Black Cat or The Telltale Heart, both of them involve very old superstitions, fear of black cats, and then the evil eye or meloikio or various other terms for that common notion. But what Poe does is he begins to transform them into what we recognize as psychopathology. And that of course, is a new science at that time. And sometimes it came by the name of a kind of psychiatry or psychology, but it was also called phrenology, which was sort of reading the bumps on the head to trying to determine character, which we've now sort of acknowledged as a kind of or debunked as a pseudoscience. But at the time, it wasn't clear. And Poe always exploited the ground between what seemed like it was true or could be true and what wasn't. One of the last stories he wrote was Von Kempelen and his discovery, where he had tried to exploit the gold rush of 1849 and do a story about alchemy and turning metals into gold. And he was interested in I think, as Jerry said, the mechanisms of terror. He was also interested in treasure hunting. You know, movies like National Treasure certainly derive from the gold bug, which has codes in it and the promise of buried treasure. And what could be more American than a get-rich-quick scheme rooted in a mystery? And Poe was in tune with that.
And playing it large and becoming a star in the process. Let's get a call from Amosville, Virginia. Valerie, you're on the air, Valerie.
Thank you, Tom. I think that what has just been said is what I also agree with, that we love, as humans, being slightly frightened by what we don't know.
We do.
Shakespeare and Dickens also slightly frightened us with everything, and we like the macabre. But with the analogies to people who are currently, you know, stars, as you say, he's writing, and Stephen King you've mentioned, but also we are slightly frightened by Mick Jagger, in a way, are we not?
Sympathy for the devil and all that.
Well, you know, and to be honest with you, when you mentioned the Pants episode, I thought immediately of Tom Jones.
Tom Jones.
By him.
What the sort of picaresque romantic? But no, though, not the gothic, is it? Or what's the link there, Valerie?
I think she means the singer.
Tom.
He famously split his pants in Vegas.
He's slightly frightening in some ways.
So you think they would have been ready to throw their panties at Edgar Allan Poe?
Not at all, not in that day and age. But what I do think is that we slightly like to be intimidated, and he did certainly do that as a writer.
Oh, that's wonderful. Valerie, thanks for your call. I want to bring one more voice here in if I may. With us from the College of the Holy Cross in Worcester, Massachusetts, is Susan Elizabeth Sweeney, Beth Sweeney, professor of English there, author of Detecting Texts, the Metaphysical Detective Story from Poe to Postmodernism. We're feeling very smart, Susan, just hearing that. Thank you for joining us today.
Hello. Happy belated Edgar Allan Poe's birthday to
yes,
everyone.
Yes, almost on it. We were a little busy earlier this week. You draw the line straight from Poe to CSI. Is that fair?
Yes, definitely. In fact, I would even draw it further to Dexter as well.
Dexter, this is, on Showtime or something on cable? This is the guy who goes after serial killers but is a killer himself?
Exactly, yes.
Sounds very Poe in its origins.
Yes, one of the fascinating things about Poe's detective stories is how Poe took the gothic fascination with horror and brutal crimes, madness, the irrational things that couldn't be solved, and figured out a way to solve them. So that in CSI, when we have disgusting, horrible, brutal murders, and then at the same time a very cold-blooded, calculated forensic science that examines them and solves them, that comes right out of Poe.
Well, you know, one night recently there was something political, and I don't get to watch as much television, but the show after, whatever speech it was CSI, and there was a murder, and then a body in a plastic bag dumped in a swamp or something, and the camera goes inside and shows the decomposition, dark and glistening, of this body. I wasn't even thinking about doing an Edgar Allan Poe show at the moment, but Beth, I looked at that, and I couldn't help but think, Poe, dark, glistening, anatomical, explicit, and there, dead in the swamp.
Yes, and in Poe's first true detective story, one of the things I'm interested in and would like to mention to your listeners is the process by which Poe sort of gradually came to discover the detective story. But in his first true detective story, he has a detective, Dupin, who is both his sidekick, his admiring sidekick, who narrates the story, talks about him as a double figure, who's both the creative and the resolvent. He has the ability both to imagine creating or perpetrating a crime and also solving it. And it's that kind of doubleness that I think can be found in many of Poe's stories. And many of the ways in which we have a sense of Poe through his literature of someone who wrote in many different genres and had different moods, but was always sort of both able to be very emotional, very intense, and yet tried very hard to control some of that emotion in a very dispassionate, systematic, objective way.
Mm.
And that's why partly I've also been thinking recently of the protagonist of Dexter as being sort of like a Poe character, because Dexter, for those who haven't seen the show, is a serial killer, but he's also a forensic scientist who specializes in analyzing blood spatter. And so he has that same kind of doubleness. But what's interesting, too, is that the show includes voiceover narration by Dexter, and so viewers of the show can't help but identify with Dexter, no matter how uneasy that might make them feel, which is the position that Poe put many of his readers in, readers of stories like The Telltale Heart, which you mentioned mm-hmm. before.
Beth Sweeney, remind us just how, I mean, he could be very gory. Murder in the Rue Morgue, you've got an awful crime, a mother and daughter murdered, and remind us what's found, how they were murdered?
It's really the most awful crime you can imagine. It's a double murder. One woman's throat has been cut with such ferocity that when the police investigate the scene and touch the body, the head comes off.
The tongue torn out?
Yes, and another body thrust up the chimney with such extreme force that it takes two or three people to bring the body out. And so Poe, again, in that story, he really presented the most brutal, gory, disturbing, sort of senseless crime I think he could imagine.
Jerry Kennedy, in his day, was this seen as thrilling or sick or both?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think Poe was working at a time when people were beginning to become interested in what we would now think of as police work, detective activities, and so forth. The first American police forces were actually created in the early 1840s, about the time that Poe...
Sounds like we may have lost Jerry there. Steve Rackman...
Yes.
How about you on this issue of sick or thrilling, or you know, the reception that kind of super gory stuff received?
I'll just take up where Jerry left off, and you know, the Dupin stories are set in Paris, mm-hmm. and Paris had an earlier metropolitan police force, as did London, which had the earliest, and there's a sense of an amateur detective coming in to the modern scene of the city, the metropolis, which is beyond everyone's comprehension, and it's sort of represented fragmentarily in newspapers. And so the horror, you know, I think it's Jerry that wrote an article a long time ago where he said Poe is so interesting that he is on the one hand the author of all these gothic and horrific notions and also the author of the rational analytic detective story. And so attempting to sort of conquer the unknowable, the monstrous with the rational, he creates the super mastermind who goes into elaborate detail. You know, in Marie Roget, which is based on a real murder in New York that he transposes to Paris, you get elaborate descriptions of floating bodies and why bodies float and when they come to the surface.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today about Edgar Allan Poe, master of the macabre, at 200, January 19th, 1809, his birth. And, of course, we just passed that date this week. We've been joined this hour from Nice in France by Michigan State's Stephen Rockman. He's there for a big Edgar Allan Poe conference this week in Nice. From Baton Rouge, Louisiana, J. Gerald Jerry Kennedy is with us, author of the portable Edgar Allan Poe, Oxford Historical Guide to Edgar Allan Poe, and much more. His forthcoming book is Illusions of National Destiny. And Susan Elizabeth Beth Sweeney joins us from the College of the Holy Cross, Holy Cross in Worcester, Massachusetts, author of Detecting Text, the Metaphysical Detective Story from Poe to postmodernism. Here's a bit from Roger Corman's 1960 movie adaptation of Poe's short story, The Fall of the House of Usher, published 1839. He's seen as the father of the short story. Here, actor Vincent Price plays Roderick Usher, head of the House of Usher, in this scene, explaining to his sister's fiancé that the Ushers, the family, is cursed.
The history of the Ushers is a history of savage degradations. First in England, and then in New England. And always in this house. Always in this house. Pall of evil which fills it is no illusion. For hundreds of years, foul thoughts and foul deeds have been committed within its walls. The house itself is evil now.
No, I cannot believe this.
But you must. For Madeline's sake, you must.
Foul thoughts, foul deeds, the house itself is evil. Beth in Schenectady, New York, you're on the air, Beth.
I was going to say that I think Poe would be interested in that. The United States, I believe, has the highest per capita rate of serial killers and psychiatrists.
I had no idea. Okay. we'll entertain it.
We tie with Russia, but that we also, I read a few years back in the New York Times that the character Hannibal Lecter was based in part on a psychiatrist, let's put it this way, they did a write-up, a small article hidden in the New York Times about a psychiatrist who was also a cannibal in the Midwest.
Beth, your line is very rough, but we've got the gist of it there. Jerry Kennedy, Beth, reading the United States has the highest per capita rate of serial killers and psychiatrists. I don't know if they thought in terms of psychiatry in the early 19th century, but what about the link?
Oh, I think there definitely is a link, because one of the interesting aspects of Poe's work is that he was so interested in the human mind and in different parts of the human mind, so that in a story like William Wilson, which is a sort of an early attempt to sort of start to move towards something like the detective story, he has the kind of personified figure of conscience. And in another story, he talks about the imp of the perverse, whatever it is in human beings that makes us do something that not only we know we shouldn't do, but that is really self-destructive for us to do.
Jerry Kennedy, I think you've got a reading from William Wilson for us. I don't know this work of Poe's, Will. Tell us something about it and maybe give us a read.
Well, as Beth said, this is a story that picks up the doppelganger motif, the idea of a double. The title character, William Wilson, is a debauched character who is going to a boarding school and meets a boy who has his same name and who resembles him. Mm. One night he decides to sneak into his room to play some kind of a dirty trick. And what happens there really epitomizes the idea of terror in Poe. Here's the passage. Mm. Assured of his being asleep, I returned, took the light, and with it again approached the bed. Close curtains were around it, which, in the prosecution of my plan, I slowly and quietly withdrew. When the bright rays fell vividly upon the sleeper, and my eyes at the same moment upon his countenance, I looked, and a numbness, an iciness of feeling instantly pervaded my frame. My breast heaved, my knees tottered, my whole spirit became possessed with an objectless yet intolerable horror. Grasping for breath, I lowered the lamp in still nearer proximity to the face. Were these the lineaments of William Wilson? I saw indeed that they were his, but I shook as if with a fit of the ague, in fancying they were not. And I think the great thing about that passage is that Poe never explains what it is that Wilson sees. Mm-hmm. What is it that so shocks this character that he wants to leave the school and get away from this character? You could spin out lots of theories that there's some kind of other appearance. I've always been struck by the fact that what Wilson is looking at here is a resemblance of himself mm-hmm. as asleep, or as a kind of corpse version of himself.
Stephen Rackman, in France, there's this sort of psychiatry side of Poe, or the focus on the psychological, but he also is this meticulous kind of mechanic of the detective story. Abraham Lincoln used to read him, you remind us, to sharpen his mind, to read and reread Poe's detective stories, to stay crisp, Stephen.
That's right. Poe did not call them detective stories. He called them tales of ratiocination.
What?
And ratiocination. It's always a mouthful. And
what does it mean?
It means, it's not such an easy word to translate, but we generally think of it as of analysis. That ratio is the use of logic and reason to solve a problem. And so ratiocination was something that people often associated these stories with. And Poe, one friend of Poe showed these tales to a lawyer in the 1840s, and they were just, fascinated by the logical chain of deduction. I mean, today we tend to look at them as quaint or maybe a little bit charming in that regard, but I think people in those days often took them quite seriously as deductive lessons. There was, there wasn't anything as an alternative to that. And so there is an aura of method and reasoning about them. And of course, what you're reasoning about is the unreasonable. Uh-huh. And that perverseness that Beth alluded to is often there. That tension between the utterly barbaric and nightmare vision and the surface of Poe's stories. Often students, students love Poe and people have this great affection for him and they have affection for the stories, but often the surface language of them is quite philosophical or mixture of the gruesome and the philosophical.
Fascinating to imagine Abraham Lincoln rereading these to keep his mind sharp of all things. Let's get a call from Boston. And Bella, hi, Bella, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just got back from Charleston on another story, and I decided to spend a day on Sullivan's Island. And that's where, of course, the gold bug was sat, because Poe was stationed at Fort Moultrie for a couple of years.
Oh, this is after Bella English, the reporter, and you're tracing Poe. He was in the military in Boston and then Charleston. Yes.
Yeah, Sullivan's Island.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is, I'm in search of who the real Annabel Lee is. Now I know the popular school of thought is that it was Virginia, his cousin, that he married when she was 13 and he
mm-hmm.
was 27.
Mm-hmm.
But if you go down south, they claim, of course, claim Poe is theirs. And they also claim that Annabel Lee, some of them do, was really Annabel Lee Ravenel.
They claim because when his own parents died, he ended up in Virginia with the Allen family, of course, and that whole line of his descent. So,
right. Well, I'm talking about the deep south, the real south,
mm-hmm,
Charleston.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And if you go out on Sullivan's Island, Fort Moultrie, of course, is still there, and there's streets. There's a Poe Street. There's a Raven Street. There's a Goldbug Street.
Wow.
Had lunch at Poe's Tavern. And people down there, and there's an Edgar Allan Poe library, which is built right to the side of an old ammunition building. It's really cool. And they had all this 200th birthday stuff going on.
Mm-hmm.
But they seem to think, at least some people in Charleston, seem to think that Annabel Lee was the daughter of Dr. Charles Ravenel. Now, Ravenel is an old Southern blue blood name.
Mm-hmm.
And that he fell in love with Annabel Lee, the daughter, when he was stationed down there. And that the doctor was appalled because, he was an enlisted man. And
mm-hmm.
he didn't want an enlisted man marrying his daughter.
We've got the experts right here, Bella. Let us pick it up and see if we can disentangle it. Jerry Kennedy, what about it? Who is Annabel Lee?
Well, if there is any connection with a Miss Ravenel in South Carolina, I'd have to say that it left no traces in any of the letters we have in Poe. I think a much more plausible argument can be made that this is at least inspired by Poe's youthful romance with Sarah Ellen Royster, the young woman he was engaged to when he went off to the University of Virginia, whose father broke up the relationship and forbade Poe from speaking to his daughter, and in fact married her off to another man at the very time that Poe was coming back in disgrace from Charlottesville.
So maybe right there, Bella reporting in from Poe country. That's all good stuff down at the Poe Tavern. Let's get a call from John in Boston. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Just give me a minute here. I'm putting the last brick in the wall.
Bricklaying, oh dear, and oh dear. You'll never be at ease with yourself again,
no,
you know, John.
The love of God, Monstressa, that wonderful line. But, this is a wonderful program, but what I kind of miss is Poe's humor. He's written some very funny short stories also. One of them, which I'm sure you're guests are familiar with, is Conversations with the Mummy.
Conversations with the Mummy.
Or Some Words with the Mummy.
Yes. That's a delightful one. That's really funny, where they revive this, a group of amateur scientists and philosophers revive this Egyptian mummy with galvanic shock, which was big in those days. And they have a conversation with him, and they try to impress him with all the modern conveniences and the achievements of the 19th century. And, of course, he shoots them down each time with the achievements of ancient Egypt.
The Mummy and his dry wit.
It's really funny.
All wrapped up in himself, sorry.
It's delightful. And there's a wonderful little thing, a collection of little swindles. I think he called it diddles. That was really a lot of fun, too.
Diddling.
Diddling is an exact science.
So anyway, the humor is there, too.
Great. Let us remember the humor. Duly noted. Thanks, John. Let's get one from Norfolk, Virginia. Marie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I wanted to bring up one of my favorite poems from Edgar Allan Poe, which, you know, when I was in school, we got to hear all of the classics, but The Bells is actually what taught me how to read poetry.
Oh, yes. Beth Sweeney, I think that may be one of your favorites as well, and that repetition, the mimicking of the sound of the bells, Beth.
Yes, it's another way in which Poe was a great innovator in really trying to push at the very limits, I think, of what language could express.
Describe what he does there.
Well, he constructs a series of alliteration and internal rhyme and onomatopoeia to duplicate in a poem with words the sound that bells make, and not just the sound that bells make, but the sound that bells of different pitches make.
And at the end of that poem where he's just writing bell, 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 over and over, that's kind of rock and roll in itself, isn't it?
It is, yes. He really does push, I think, at the limits of language. And Poe, as I know both Jerry and Steve know very well, too, was interested in language itself, in language that didn't mean something, in language that was ambiguous, in codes, in cryptograms. But one of the things I always enjoy about The Bells is that there is one of the many wonderful books on Poe is a book by Daniel Hoffman, which is called Poe, 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 Poe. And it sort of plays on the repetition of bells. But I like to think that there's no other writer, one of whose critics would produce a book whose title consisted of just that critic's name.
That's wonderful.
Poet's name repeated.
Wonderful. A nod to the language. Stephen Reckman in France, remind us, our time dwindles, but remind us of the bizarre story of Poe's death. I mean, I'm looking here. You tell us how it went. What we know.
What do we know? We know very little, and we speculate very much.
1849, October 7th. He disappears, and then
he
appears.
The general story is that he may have been cooped, which was a way of keeping people. And having them vote on an election day and taken from tavern to tavern where the voting and the polling took place in those days.
I mean, he was found on the streets of Baltimore. He's delirious.
He's taken to the hospital. He raves a little bit, says, Reynolds, 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 Lord have mercy on my soul, and he's dead. His family those relations that are there are called in. They happen to be hostile relations. He's sort of minimally cared for and dumped in a pauper's grave where he remains until 1875 when a committee with some trouble raises funds to have a reburial and a ceremony for him.
With only Walt Whitman representing all of literary America there.
Except for local poets in the area. That we don't really talk about much these days. But Whitman knew him in New York.
I see these charges here. Epilepsy, syphilis, cholera, rabies, Jerry Kennedy, all this tagged on Poe and his death. Any of that fair? Do we have any idea what?
Well, there have been multiple theories, as Steve was mentioning. The rabies theory came up a few years ago based on the fact that Poe spent a night in prison in Philadelphia shortly before he went down to Richmond to seal the deal with Sarah Elmira Royster, whose husband had died and whom Poe was going to marry then, and he was really on the verge of realizing his great literary ambition of owning a literary magazine when this catastrophe befell him in Baltimore.
Catastrophe, delirium, and death, and now, of course, every January on the anniversary of his birth, the Poe toaster there at the grave, who leaves a half-full bottle of cognac and three roses for Poe. It's been going on for 50 years, a mystery in itself. So much we haven't come to, but what a wonderful thing to remember and conversation, thanks to you. J. Gerald Kennedy at Louisiana State, thank you so much for being with us today, Professor Kennedy.
You're very welcome. My pleasure.
Stephen Rackman in Nice, in France, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Tom.
And Susan Elizabeth Sweeney at the College of Holy Cross in Worcester, Massachusetts. Beth Sweeney, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Tom. And I want to urge all your listeners to read some Poe that they haven't read yet.
Let's do it. And a toast to Poe. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thanks for joining us.